A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
The Science of Sports Podcast with Professor Ross Tucker and sports journalist Mike Finch. Coming up in this episode.
Competition can have a very dark side for me in terms of comparison, in terms of being driven to win at all costs. The obsessive thought patterns started to kind of fixate around food. When I was in the hospital, my heart stopped. I started to see how important it was to take care of my body and how important it was to feed my body, not the number on the scale.
She's been called the Queen of Pain, and her name is Amelia Boone. And we're about to play you a podcast, an interview we did with her around her journey in the sport of obstacle racing, and probably more importantly, her journey with the eating disorders. And for many of you that follow the story of Amelia Boone, in fact, that follow any kind of sporting blogs and news, you will have heard of Amelia Boone. She was very well featured on the cover of Runner's World magazine in the United States. And they've really reported on her story quite widely on a number of different publications. But most famous for having suffered an eating condition for 20 years, celebrated as one of the best obstacle races in the world, and suddenly coming out as somebody that still suffers from the condition and being very open about how she suffers from that condition. So we decided to interview her on the basis of some of the discussions and the podcasts we've done previous to this around this condition called Red S. And she's, I don't think she's a poster girl for it, but in some respects, she is one of those people that suffers from this condition and has taken this idea of this body image of hers around the sport that she does to another level and probably a disturbing level.
Well, she herself says in a revelationary piece in July, and I remember reading this, it came across Twitter, and it was such a powerful piece because she's obviously been thinking and grappling for 20 years with this. She talks about how she's still not recovered and dealing with these things, but she was so candid in this piece that I really think it was powerful. And she says in it, "I've known for a long time that I'm the living, walking example of Red S." So she'll take that title herself. And you know, we spoke in our previous episode about Red S a little bit in the context of Mary Kane and the issues around the Salazar camp.
So just to explain to those who didn't listen to that podcast, yeah. Known as relative energy deficiency in sport.
Right. So it used to be known as the female athlete triad, but it's been changed and expanded effectively because it was felt that wasn't comprehensive enough. Because the female athlete triad is characterized by three things, as you'd guess from the name. The one is low energy availability with or without an eating disorder, menstrual dysfunction, so loss of the periods, and low bone mineral density. But the experts in this field recognize that actually there's much more to it. There are endocrine consequences. There are cardiovascular, gastrointestinal, psychological, all kinds of other systems are affected. And men are affected. And so the athlete triad effectively evolved and expanded into Red S. And what basically happens is that low energy availability triggers the body to shut down reproductive function. That's why athletes lose their periods, because it's for survival purposes. And a number of other different things. And so as soon as that happens, the body no longer has the estrogen that it needs. And that leads to all sorts of second order effects. So now you get loss of bone because estrogen, one of estrogen's many functions in the body, is to shut off the breakdown of bone and to switch on the building of bone. So now you mess up the balance. Cardiovascular functions and so forth, obviously reproductive. So it's a pretty complex condition and not much is known about it.
Yeah.
And so, you know, Amelia obviously knows about it. And her experience is, I think, what we really wanted to get out of it because, you know, we can talk to scientists and you can talk to people all day about the theory and what's known, but someone who's lived it and can give practical input, I think, is what we really hope Amelia. And she's done podcasts and she said that she wants to have this conversation to help other people understand. And I hope that she gets that opportunity as a result of speaking to us.
So one of the questions, that many questions we're going to ask her in this podcast, and we're going to ask this to you, Ross, first. One of the things that I always find difficult to understand about women's sport in principle is that we understand that lighter and stronger is always going to be better in sport, you know, particularly in the sport that she's involved in, obstacle racing. Well, your perception is, let's say the perception is. In a sport like that she's doing, where you need to climb over obstacles, you need to have a lot of strength, the body weight you have, your weight to power ratio is critically important in that space. Is it not fair to say that the pressure on athletes of her caliber in that particular sport are to be as light and as lean as possible, even to the long-term detriment of yourself?
Yeah, but then you've got to define as possible, because there comes a point where in your loss of body mass, you start to lose strength and power. Yeah. And remember, if the cause of this is low energy availability, think about what that energy availability is. It's quite literally the fuel tank of the body. That's what it's doing. And if it's so low that you're running on empty, then you will no longer perform at all. So plus you get the consequences of injury and illness. And Amelia will talk to us about her stress fractures, which she attributes directly to this. So the key in your question is as possible. What you need is to get as low as possible without compromising health and performance.
Yeah.
Now the health, the compromised health comes later. You know, you don't just suddenly get a stress fracture. You don't just suddenly stop having periods. The compromised performance comes sooner. And so when an athlete starts complaining about chronic fatigue, they can't recover from hard workouts, they feel tired all the time, they're not sleeping particularly well, they don't feel rested when they wake up. As a coach or as a physiologist or a doctor, you should be looking at that and saying, maybe this athlete is training too hard relative to what their diet and recovery strategies are giving them.
Yeah.
And if you fix that, then the athlete will find a natural body weight that is optimal for them. And it won't be a specific point. It won't be 61 kilograms, or it won't be 126 pounds. It'll be somewhere 3 to 4 kilograms range, to, you know, to either side of that. And that will vary over the course of the season. It'll vary depending on the training they're doing and so forth. And that's kind of your approach. You have to let the body find that optimal weight. And if you go below it, then you lower than as possible, and you start to get acute problems because you just simply can't fuel the exercise. By the way, studies have come out now recently looking at these low-carb diets, which tend to be low in calories.
Yeah.
And what happens is the athlete just cannot sustain high-intensity training.
Yeah.
So they actually lose the ability to train and race harder. So you have to fuel properly. And you can't drive yourself below that point, because you'll suffer acutely. And as I mentioned, and as we explored previously, you get all these clinical complications that just aren't worth it.
Well, as you're listening to this podcast, you'll see some of these themes coming up in the conversation with Amelia, and it's important to understand the background. But here is our interview with Amelia Boone. Amelia Boone, welcome to the Science of Sport podcast. I kind of feel like I know you, because we've done so much research in the build-up to this podcast. There's so much stuff on the interwebs about you, and that you're almost famous, and obviously you don't know us as well as we know you. Are you aware of your sort of world famousness?
I don't know if I would say world famous. It's flattering. But I mean, I think that it's been something that's been totally different for me that I haven't expected. But it's been really cool to, like, you know, meet lots of people through that wonderful thing that we call the internet. And that so many people have related, I think, to my own journey and story and whatnot.
Yeah. So let's just, have a look at your, there are many sort of events that you've won, and you were obviously known as the Queen of Pain for many, many years. You've won 3 times one of the world's toughest mudder. Just explain what the toughest mudder is, just for us who don't know too much about obstacle racing.
Yes, absolutely. It is a 24-hour obstacle race. So you run as many laps of a 5-mile, about 25 obstacle course as you can in 24 hours. And it's an extremely, extremely brutal event, because if you think about running that far, and then also you are climbing over things, you're hanging from things, it's pretty much what it'd be like if it was a American Ninja Warrior, but with lots of running in between all of those obstacles.
I see you're also a Spartan Race World Champion as well, and the Spartan Race Point mm-hmm. Series Champion, and three times the Death Race finisher. Death Race sounds quite a serious event.
Right? Yeah, I'm laughing about something called the Death Race. Yeah, it's a very strange event. It was very much a... it's very much a mental kind of, it's hard to explain, but I would say it's kind of similar to adventure racing, in terms of like lots of different tasks and things like that over multiple days.
And can you die if you don't win or you don't finish?
I have not, I'm still alive. And so hopefully not. I don't think anybody has died so far. Knock on wood.
It works the other way. If you die, you can't win.
If you die, you can't win.
But that's where
you can't win.
That's where your brain saves you. Central governor comes to rescue you from yourself.
Yeah, so that's a podcast all on its own.
There we go.
Yeah.
Just tell us, knocking some sense into yourself. How much do you hate yourself?
Yes. Yeah. Well, that's kind of where I'm going to lead into the first question. And I think of all the research that we've done, one of the things that seems to be missing for me is that a lot of people talk about your history basically from your teenage life and until now. I'm interested to know where it all started. I mean, your early childhood, where did you grow up? What was your sort of environment like when you were growing up?
Yeah, I grew up outside of Portland, Oregon, which is still one of my favorite places in the entire world.
Amelia, when you say just outside, where exactly? Because I go there as often as I can and I love it. And I'm just curious if I've been to where you grew up.
So I grew up kind of like West Portland, like the hills, in a suburb actually called Lake Oswego.
Okay.
In that area.
Yeah, very nice.
And have you been there? No?
I've been through there because I go to Portland and then I hop in a car and I've driven both directions towards Mount Hood, and then I went out to Cannon Beach one time, and I mean, it's just mm-hmm. beautiful, beautiful place. I could go there tomorrow.
Oh yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's amazing. And I had a great childhood, and I have a wonderful family. My parents are my absolute best friends. My sister and I are super close. And I grew up as kind of a kid involved. People always ask me about athletic background, and I grew up playing a lot of different team sports. I was that kid that went from softball practice to soccer practice over to basketball and then different club things. And I was just always kind of on the go. And it was great. And I was a good athlete, and I was just kind of pretty good at everything, not super excellent, but enough to really be on these kind of like traveling teams and whatnot at a young age.
And your folks, I mean, were they the kind of folks that were supportive, or were they kind of cheerleaders? Or, I mean, you always hear of those parents at the school days where the parents are kind of living through their own misadventures through their kids. Was that a case, or your folks had a healthy relationship with your sport?
Oh, they had an absolute healthy relationship with my sport. My dad, unfortunately, I pitched in softball, and so he always like sat on a 5-gallon bucket for hours on end while I threw balls at his shin. And he was, you know, he was my softball coach, and they were very supportive. I think they recognized in me from a very young age that I had some type of intrinsic internal self-motivation. And if anything, I needed to kind of be told to calm down and that I don't have to be perfect at everything, because I was very hard on myself in school. If I wasn't getting super straight A's, if I wasn't the teacher's pet, like then they would see how it would affect me. And I remember my parents being like, hey, we're happy with B's and C's. So they were never high pressure. If anything, they adjusted very well to what my personality was as a kid and understood that I actually needed more perspective as opposed to like motivation.
It's interesting, isn't it? And we'll come back to the timeline of the story and how it develops in a moment, but how many personalities there are like that in endurance sport? Have you found that mm-hmm. as well? It's an interesting...
Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's funny because people always ask with endurance, and it's talking to endurance athletes, it tends to be people who... we don't really know why we do it, and we don't really know where the motivation comes from, because people always ask, like, how can I be more motivated, or how can I do this? And I say, I'm like, I don't, it's just always been there for me. But it does seem to be a common theme, a caught in the thread. But clearly there are also pitfalls with that.
Yeah, I was just going to say, it is a double-edged sword, which then leads mm-hmm. us, I guess, into the article you wrote.
I'm sorry to kind of interrupt this, but I think what I'm interested in is, have you ever thought about what is the motivation? I get that some people are born with this kind of motivation behind this drive to succeed. But have you ever sort of looked at it and thought, well, this is the reason why I'm like this? I mean, people talk about sibling rivalry and all those sort of things. That's why I asked you the question about your parents. But that wasn't a driver. Was it just, do you feel something you were born with? Or was there some other drive you had to look deep, dark inside yourself?
Nature, nurture issue there.
Yeah, exactly. You know, the only thing that I can point to in terms of and this wouldn't relate to sports, I think, but this more relates to school and career, is that I grew up in a very affluent suburb, and my family was not affluent by any means. And I think I started to harbor as a kid a lot of resentment towards everyone around me who seemed to have everything and were given everything and didn't have to worry about things. And they all got brand new cars when they were 16 and whatnot. And I think there was a part of me in terms of school and in terms of motivation for career is that I said to myself, I'm like, I don't want to be the person worrying about, you know, like being able to pay the bills like the rest of my life and things like that. And so there was a definite motivation there in me from that angle. But in terms of, that's the only maybe environmental factor that I can really point to. But I do know, I remember probably when I was 7 or 8 years old, first kind of feeling like there was something a little bit wrong with me. And that I just felt different than other kids in terms of like, I was very emotional and I was very scared of things. And I was very much like needed routine and structure. And if things didn't go to plan, then I started to freak out as a kid. And so I do think that I did internalize at a younger age that maybe there was something wrong with me, and that kind of took hold.
Yeah. We're always looking at these motivations for people, why they get to the level that they do in sports. And there's obviously, there's not some science, but there's always a fair amount of hypotheses around elite sports people and what motivates them, because there is such sacrifice involved at the top level of sport that often it needs an extra driver to get there, which is why it's fascinating talking to you about some of those drivers, which obviously played a part in that move towards being an elite athlete.
Yeah, and I think I actually, honestly, with athletics, I stayed away from competitive athletics for a while. You know, after I went through eating disorder recovery in high school and in college, and I knew that competition can have a very dark side for me in terms of comparison, in terms of being driven to win at all costs. So I wasn't quite sure that was something that would be healthy for me. So I remember people would be like, oh, you should like try and run a half marathon, or you should do this X, Y, and Z. And I initially really didn't want to be, you know, time ranked and judged. I was afraid of what that could ignite in me, honestly.
And that was at the age of your late teens, is that right?
Yes.
So How did this motivation that you talk about, that gnawing feeling inside you that you sort of said germinated at about the age of 8, how did it come to lead to the first diagnosis when you were 16 years old?
Yeah, so I was diagnosed with obsessive compulsive disorder when I was pretty young, so around the age of 8, 9, 10. I don't remember exactly. It's funny how much kind of goes in terms of your memory. And I was talking to my parents the other day. I'm like, do you remember exactly when that was? And none of us could remember. Because I had a lot of different like fears and phobias and obsessive thought patterns that wouldn't get out of my head. And I remember when I was a sophomore in high school, the obsessive thought patterns started to kind of fixate around food. And I started to become scared of food. And I started to kind of like start to play games with it in terms of like, how little can I get by on? And I don't really know what the motivation was there. It was never I was always a very active kid. I was always a very lean kid. So it was never an external pressure. No one was ever saying, you know, you need to slim down, you need to lose weight, you know, and the body image actually really wasn't even a part of it for me. It was almost just this like fear or phobia. And so I think that for we all kind of thought, my parents kind of thought that it was just kind of that the food fears was just another manifestation of my obsessive compulsive disorder, and didn't really understand that it was like a completely separate type of diagnosis.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things you talk about in some of the literature that I've read is that when you were in your high school years, you were obviously, you were mocked for being looking sick. Is that because you were very lean?
No, I mean, I was not, I don't know if I was mocked, but I, in high school, I think when I was hospitalized because I was very medically unstable. But I was very, very visibly sick. I mean, in terms of, if you looked at me, you would say like, there's something very wrong with her because I was way too skinny. And in general, in principle, I don't like to talk about weights because they're very triggering for people who are dealing with eating disorders. And I always like to say eating disorders are not about weight. But it was very, you know, I had, as much as we can talk about how BMI is not a good indicator of things, it was in a place where I was so ill that when I was in the hospital, my heart stopped just because, and my temperature, core temperature, was like down in the low 90s and things like that. And so I was very, very sick. I think that was something that was very scary for me at that age.
Absolutely. Just as an aside, a very quick physiology. It's interesting you talk about your core temperature being that low. We spoke about how the body needs a certain amount of energy to keep the lights on, as it were. And when your energy availability is so low, one of the things the body sacrifices is the ability to keep warm. So it's also a classic manifestation from the beginning. What was the trigger to go to the hospital in the first place? Was it parental concern, or was there an other medical issue that triggered that?
I remember, so I had approached my parents, and I remember a number of times saying like, I'm really scared of food. I don't really know what's going on. And it was actually my soccer coach, my freshman high school soccer coach, who I pulled my parents aside and said, Amelia is not looking good. Like, you know, over these past few months, he kind of saw a change in me. And so they took me to see my primary care doctor, and the primary care doctor ran tests on me and did these things called orthostatics, which is pretty much they lay down, they take your heart rate and blood pressure, and then they have you stand up and they do that. And I mean, and then my doctor said to me, like, she needs to go to the hospital right now. Like, she is going to die if you do not take her to the hospital. And they did. And that night, first night in the hospital, my heart stopped. They were able to get me back into rhythm. So I'm very, very grateful for that. Because had I not been in the hospital that night, I don't know what would have happened. But that was kind of the trigger for it all. And it happened very, very quickly. Yeah. And I was very caught off guard.
Yeah. And I will say one thing is that whoever that doctor is, obviously you owe a huge debt, but I don't know if you realize that there have been some studies done where they interviewed hundreds of physicians, and only 37% recognized the signs of what was then called the female triad.
Yeah.
And, so this is a massively misunderstood condition. And I don't know if the doctor you saw then recognized what he was dealing with clinically, other than to test. So that orthostatic test is checking how well your body can defend blood pressure. Maybe that's a standard test, but I mean, you got a doctor who did exactly the right thing for you.
Yeah, luckily. And I think I was at a young age so I was 15, and I didn't start, I was late through puberty as well. So I don't even think that they would have called it the female athlete triad, because I think at that point I maybe only had one or two periods in my life. And so that also, there were no, at that age, it's very difficult to see a lot of warning signs, especially if you're a female that's like late into puberty.
No, of course. You're right. They wouldn't have diagnosed it as that, but you at least recognized the root cause of the issue and what needed to be done. So, So then you're in the hospital. Obviously, this is a call to action. It's a frightening experience, I would imagine. And there's a degree of treatment which semi-sticks, doesn't, the way I was reading it in the blog, and you all the way through college. And it was interesting, yes. in your blog you wrote that your disorder seemed to quiet during college. And I was just wondering what that meant, how it happened, why it quieted.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Yeah, I mean, I think that there's a number of factors in terms of what I've realized, especially with restrictive eating disorders like anorexia, like I was diagnosed with, it is very much habit reversal in a lot of ways. And so for somebody who has a lot of fears around food, if you keep avoiding those fears or if you keep avoiding things because of that fear, they become scarier and scarier and scarier. Through treatment, it was a lot of almost fear. It was fear exposure therapy. So the more that I would eat something, the more that I would, you know, stick to my meal plan, then like the fears of those foods would lessen. And the thought patterns would quiet. There's a lot of medical science behind this too. When you are weight restored to a weight that is healthy for your body, where all of your systems are functioning, it actually does have a psychological effect in terms of reducing those anxieties around food as well. When you're extremely malnourished, it causes all different, and I don't know the exact science, but it does cause all different types of obsessions to worsen. And so I think that that's really like, as long as I was staying in therapy, as long as I was sticking to my meal plan and doing all that things, and the fears would kind of quiet. But the problem is, the further away you get from something, you kind of start to take your attention to it, being attentive and combating against it, starts to lessen. And so little by little, and with me not even really understanding, is that old habits and old fears started to creep back in because I wasn't vigilant about it. So I ended up relapsing my sophomore year of college really badly, and then spent the next 3 years of college pretty much fighting with the school to let me stay and not kick me out because I was very sick. But the issue was that I was also very high functioning at the time. I was, I was a 4.0 student. You know, I was a resident advisor. I was a teaching assistant. I mean, I was top of the class in everything. And so it's kind of hard to say, okay, well, she's very, very sick, but she seems to be doing really well. She's super functional. But I think that that's actually very, very common in terms of a lot of people who do suffer from eating disorders, is that they can be very high functioning until all of a sudden the body just gives out.
Yeah, I saw in your piece, you said you were so weak, you couldn't walk up a flight of stairs. I think it was your wording.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. Yes. I would walk to the top flight of my stairs and I would be dizzy and I would have to lay down and I would hide. I went to college in St. Louis. And so during the winter, I would like wear 3 or 4 pairs of tights under my jeans to try and stay warm and just try and hide from everybody how sick I had gotten.
And at this stage, how did you feel about yourself? Because in your blog post, one of the things that you were really honest about, even up front, was this battle of shame and cognitive dissonance and so on. And obviously, once you became the queen of pain and this endurance athlete, that took on a different shape. But I'm curious about how you felt about yourself, the relationship you had with yourself at this point.
Yeah, I think that I, at this point, there still was a lot of shame, because I think that in college, I had said, okay, well, Amelia, you've been through eating disorder treatment before. You know, you're in the hospital, you went through a program there in Portland. Like you should know better. You should know better. You should be able to fix this on your own. And that's why I spent 3 years telling my parents and telling everybody, no. I know what I need to do. Going back into treatment isn't going to teach me anything that I don't already know. And so there was a lot of very vicious kind of self-flagellation, telling myself, like, you're smarter than this, you should know better. But I just couldn't bring myself to do anything about it.
Yeah, that was the word I was trying to get to, self-flagellation. Mm-hmm. What about at this stage your close friends and peer group? Was there any pressure or comment? Was it helpful or unhelpful? How did that play out? Or did you hide it?
I tried to hide it as much as possible. Friends are very, very perceptive. My sophomore year roommates in college had an intervention to try. They bought me a plane ticket home because I was living so far from home and I didn't have enough money to fly home. So they wanted me to fly home so my parents could see how bad I was. So they intervened in that way. Sorry, I get emotional because I thank them for that. I was also in an a cappella group in college. My big thing, I was too weak to do anything physical. There was no activity, there was no sports, there was nothing in that realm. Yeah. But I did sing. And my a cappella group staged in a number of interventions to try and get me help as well. But the thing is that, you know, you can lead a horse, as cliche as it is, you can lead a horse to water, but you can't make him drink.
Yeah.
You know, aside from sectioning somebody, because like they can't make their own decisions. Like it's very, very hard to force somebody into treatment unless they're a minor. And I know doctors told my parents, they're like, she will recover, but it will be when she's ready to, and you can't force her to be ready to, before she is herself.
So when did the sport and the sporting sort of life start kicking off? Where does this come into play?
Yeah, so I had after college, I went into a residential program. So that was 24 hours a day. I lived in a house in Carlsbad, actually.
What age were you here about?
I was 22.
Okay.
So I had just graduated from college. And I was there for about 6 or 7 weeks until insurance kicked me out. And then I went to law school immediately after, which probably wasn't the greatest transition. But I, through that, I had once again kind of like shored up my recovery. And slowly but surely over the course of law school, the voices started to quiet again, the obsession started to quiet again. And I started to be in a really good place. Graduated law school, went to start work at a very large law firm. And, you know, I think that at that point I was pretty confident everything was kind of behind me. And then that's when I had friends who approached me, a coworker who, you know, famously came up to me and said, "Hey, there's this race called the Tough Mudder. Like we should go do it." And I saw it and I go, "Oh, they don't time you." Okay. I think I can, 'cause I was worried about that competitive aspect of me too, still. And so I went out and I ran it and I had a blast. And then I think, and so I immediately then started signing up for more. And then I slowly started to look at the more competitive ones. And so it wasn't really until, you know, I didn't really pick up the sport aspect of my life again until I was 26, 27.
Wow.
But I felt like in a very solid place, I think, at that point.
So you were actually in a good space when you took on the sport. It wasn't a result of being in a bad space that you took on the sport.
Correct. And I think that what I've done a lot of exploration over the years in terms of how I relate to sport and whether exercise, there are a lot of people who have eating disorders where compulsive exercise is a part of it, is very much that, you know, like, they hate moving their bodies, but they have to move their bodies because they need to burn calories. That was never how my disorder really manifested. Whenever I always say, I'm like, this is an inexperience of one. And eating disorders are so different from between people. But mine was never really in like that. If anything, when I started to compete, and especially when I started to do like the longer races, when I did my first World's Toughest Mudder in 2011, and I needed to run for 24 hours, I started to see how important it was to take care of my body and how important it was to feed my body and feed it appropriately. And all of a sudden I had this like performance aspect. And so I think in a lot of ways, sport actually kind of helped me initially. And then, but you know, there were some pitfalls as I as my achievements kind of grew and as my like public image kind of grew too, I think.
Those pitfalls being, for instance, that now you're in a world where not body image, but body matters and people start commenting on it. You're exposed to the magazine media world where appearances matter maybe disproportionately. People judge a book by its cover. They judge an athlete by their physique.
Yeah. And I think that I didn't really notice it at first. And I didn't really, because I was never in the running world. And I never, now you hear people talk about how if they ran cross country or track in high school or college, there are a lot of body image pressures because weight is, you know, for runners is kind of an aspect, has always kind of been an aspect of the sport. And that was new to me, but what was different is that I was doing obstacle racing, which was more, and I was heavily into CrossFit. And so it was also more about like muscle mass and strength. But I do remember when I started to receive some attention and, you know, be in magazines, then I would start to see my body and I would see one-off comments and they would kind of people, and you know, 99% of people can say something super flattering, but then you're clearly going to fixate on that one person who says something, you know, negative. But I started to kind of fall into that. And I think that when I started to do more running events and less obstacle racing, then even more I kind of thought, I'm like, okay, well, like maybe there is a way that runners' bodies should look. But I also knew that was also the reason I stuck to trails and like mountain races, because I knew that muscle was an advantage there. That muscle was an advantage and that, you know, it wasn't about like, I've never run a road marathon, for instance. So it wasn't kind of about power to weight ratio in terms of mountain races and whatnot. But it is very insidious at how it creeps in. But what's been interesting for me is that I firmly believe comments from people, they don't cause eating disorders. But if you are susceptible, like I am, to those because of my eating disorder history, then it becomes kind of, it's much, much harder to deal with.
Yeah. You mentioned, lost my train of thought.
I'm actually, while Ross is remembering his train of thought,
there, yeah.
I'm very interested to know, like, can you remember a specific comment that would affect you? In other words, you've got 99% of the comments saying good things. What sort of comments would trigger that sort of lack of self-belief or that issue?
I just remember one time I was winning. There was a picture of me crossing the finish line at a Spartan race. And I just won the race. I just won like the national series and I was celebrating. And it was just some random comment that said, weird body, you know? And I mean, I didn't say, it was just a comment that said weird body. And I remember then looking at my body and starting to pick it apart. And then I would start to be at the start line and then look at the other women around me. And I'd be like, well, okay, what do their bodies look like in comparison to mine?
Most of them were slower.
What was that?
I say most of them were slower than your body anyway.
Right. And so, and the funny thing is that like, I knew, and I've always kind of known. I'd like to think I'm an intelligent person. I knew that restricting and losing weight and things like that were actually not going to help me in terms of performance. But for some reason, it's like I couldn't help myself. And so that's where my, like everything that has gone in my eating disorders has been a little bit different, is because I never thought losing weight was going to help me perform athletically, but I kind of got stuck in the aesthetics of it, of what a runner should look like or what an elite athlete should look like. And I remember actually going online and kind of like Googling other athletes who were my height and then trying to see what they weighed. And then being like, holy crap, I weigh so much more than they do. Like maybe there is something, you know? And so it is very much like a culture that with my background, started to just kind of exacerbate, those little issues.
Yeah. No, that makes sense. It's interesting that your issue didn't start as an image one. but then it became one because of the context you found yourself in. It's really interesting.
Yeah.
I do remember my train of thought, but I'm going to park that train in the station for a while because I want to come back to it. But to pick up where you've taken the discussion now, in your piece, you spoke a lot about looking the part. And what I was going to ask you, and I think you've already answered it, but I want to explore a little more, is aside from the Google searches to compare your numbers to those of other athletes, was there any other way that you obsessed over weight? Did you measure body fat percentage all the time? Were you worried about what the scale said? Or was it really just subjective? And what at that time would have reassured you? Like if you looked at yourself and you saw veins in your leg, was that a sign you were good? Or was it something less that you could put your finger on?
Yeah, so I actually, I was petrified of scales, and still to this day, I don't get on scales. And I think that that's probably just a remnant of, from being in treatment for so long, because they would always blind weigh you. They didn't want you to know your weights because doctors would be afraid as an eating disorder patient that you would obsess over them. And so I avoided scales like the plague, and I avoided body fat kind of testing as well. But I do remember one time when I finally went and got like a DEXA scan done through one of my sponsors. And then I was like, I don't want to know my body fat percentage, but then I accidentally saw it. And so I never really kind of like measured those metrics. But what I think it was more was visual for me, or appearances, or could I see abs when because everybody else around me had abs, and I'm like, that abs aren't going to help you win this race, It was really like I knew things were wrong in my mind, but it was never the obsessive weighing. Though I mean, I have mixed thoughts on that, because part of me is thinking like, had I actually really tracked my weights, and maybe I could have taken power away from being afraid of those numbers. But I don't know.
Yeah. So you have this extremely successful athletic career like you'd had in college, although at this point your eating issues, I think you spoke about them as this elephant in the room the whole time, but not really affecting your performance. You'd managed to navigate that until eventually you couldn't, and you start to pay for the past effectively, and that's what the stress fractures were. So maybe just talk to us, because I think, correct me if I'm wrong, but over a period of about 2.5 years you have 4 of them.
So I started, I 2016 I ended up with a stress fracture in my femur when I was training to run Western States 100 miler, and I think at that point I wrote it off as just a one, everyone gets a stress fracture.
Yeah.
Like, hey, like it just happens. You train hard. I had made some training errors, et cetera, et cetera. But it was more than the repeated. Immediately after, when I came off of the stress fracture from my femur, I ended up with one in my sacrum, which then kind of set off red flags, because there are certain areas of the body where if you get a stress fracture there, it is very like much, there is something wrong. And so my doctors at that point, we did a DEXA scan, and I was concerned because when I was 16, I was diagnosed with osteopenia. My bone density was very, very low. It had reversed by the time I was about 25 or so, so I was no longer osteopenic. But we started to kind of go down that road and figure out about bone density, and then everyone was asked me, are you getting your periods? And I said, well, I have an IUD. I don't know. And I had had an IUD since I was 25. So I hadn't had a period for many, many years. And I wish that I had, realized how detrimental not knowing that, could be. But yes, it was definitely kind of all caught up to me at once.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. I mean, this process of now, when you kind of, the sport is the positive side of this journey, though, isn't it? I mean, you're kind of letting your sport dictate your eating habits in a way that's your, it's in a way it's your therapy, isn't it? That's your driver.
Yeah, I for me it was very much, when I finally came to terms that like, okay, I still have an issue, like I still have a problem. I was able to compete very highly, and at a very high level for a very long time, but you know, the body doesn't really forget, and things kind of caught up to me. And my motivation for going back into treatment was really, I wanted to get back to sport, and I wanted to be able to do it, you know, healthily and not being afraid of breaking myself. And I also wanted to really explore that relationship with sport and see, was sport something that was beneficial for me, or was it actually tied up in my eating disorder? So it was very much for me to kind of do that work and that self-examination. And I remember before I went into treatment, I think the last kind of straw for me was I was training for the Barclay Marathons, and I was 2 weeks before, and I ended up with a stress fracture in my heel. And I was just like, I can't, like, I was so upset about missing out on a race that I loved, et cetera. And then finally I was like, I need to do something about this. And so it was kind of that realization that what I was doing to myself was not congruent with what my goals and my values were.
So at that point, you decide to take it on yourself to go into treatment. And there's a phone call that you write about, and you use the word flood of emotions when you tell your folks this. What were those emotions?
I think at that point it was just, there was a lot of shame still involved, a lot of shame. It's been a theme of once again admitting that I was 35 years old. I had been dealing this for 20 years. And I still wasn't better. Cause I mean, I am a high achiever. I want to win at everything. And I wanted to win at eating disorder recovery. I wanted to be that person that raised my hand and said, I beat an eating disorder and it's no longer a problem. And I am fully 100% recovered. And here it was, you know, I had done a lot of hard things in my life, but I still could not beat this. And I think that was really kind of what came up for me then, but it was also a lot of acceptance and surrender. It was like, now is the time to do this, you know. Yeah. Like I'm done.
Yeah. So I mean, we've asked you, like, throughout this journey, how you felt and specifics and details. And I know you said earlier that every single case is unique. So I'm not sure how this question lands, whether you'll feel comfortable answering it, but what elements of your own journey do you think you can relate to others, and the advice you'd give them? Someone who's listening to this maybe relates to some of the things you've experienced, and they haven't reached that point of surrender and letting go and going in and taking on themselves. What do you say to that person?
Yeah, I think that it's something that very much when you look at, I've had a lot of people reach out to me and say, I think I have an issue with food. I'm not quite sure. Like, I don't really know. I think X, Y, and Z. I'm clearly not a therapist, though. At this point, I've been in so much therapy, I feel like I could be. I kid. But it's when your quality of life is really being affected, and everything. I mean, I spent every waking moment of my life thinking about food, and that's exhausting. And I just thought that there could be something better out there. And so I think for anybody who really is kind of like, you know, I don't really know if there's a problem, I'm not quite sure. But when it really is taking a hold of your life and impacting things, and it was impacting my relationships, you know, I couldn't go out on a date because I was afraid of eating in front of people, for instance, you know, I couldn't go to the athlete dinner the night before a race because of those types of things. And so I really think that for anyone, it's really being curious about your relationship with food. And it's very, very hard because it seems like everybody has a disordered relationship with food now, you know, like it's very hard to tell what is normal anymore. And I think that, you know, so I think that it's a lot of self-examination on the part of people.
Yeah. So while we're on the subject of advice, the train that arrived earlier, people made comments that were critical, and that obviously did tremendous damage because, as you said, you were susceptible. What I found really interesting was that there were some people who actually would compliment you, and that can also do damage. You know, they'd say exactly. something like, hey, Amelia, you're looking really fit, or you're looking strong, or you must be in great condition. And it turns out that their good intentions actually contribute to the slide. Now, what advice can you give people? I mean, it's impossible. How do you possibly mitigate your behavior without knowing? And then once someone's in that situation, what's the best thing there for want of a better word, their entourage, their close family, friends, and loved ones can do for them?
Yeah, that's a great question, because this has come up a lot, because I did, people would say to me, man, you're looking super fit. And I'm thinking back in my mind, I'm like, what does fit mean? And I see people comment on that all the time, you know, pictures of, and it seems to be particular pictures of runners saying you're looking super fit, and people are like, oh, that's a compliment. But I tell people, I'm like, there are a million things to compliment people on. Like, we do not need to talk about people's bodies in order to compliment them. It's an easy one. It's super easy. It's super lazy person compliment to be like, oh, what can I compliment them on? And so I've just made a rule of thumb that I never comment on somebody's body. And I don't, you know, I had a friend recently who lost like over 100 pounds and everyone's congratulating them, et cetera, et cetera. But what's interesting is you don't know why a person lost that much weight. They could have cancer. You know, they could, like, it may not be a good thing.
Yeah.
And so I've just kind of made it a rule of thumb to, like, never talk about somebody's body. And even, you know, and so my parents, my family learned that at a very young age. They also, because I've been dealing with this for so long, they've also learned that you look healthy is not a great thing to say either, because for anybody who has a history of a restrictive eating disorder, that probably means, you know, to them they translate as that you've gained weight or you look fat type of thing. And so people, I mean, look, everyone has the best intentions, and it's not at all saying, trying to lay blame on people. And I think that we are kind of in this culture now where I think people are paralyzed to say anything. And so, and my answer to that is just say, so don't say anything about appearances. Yeah. It's pretty much as simple as that.
Okay. So here's, you may think you've answered this, and so I'm sorry for asking it, but it's contextual because of the Mary Cain issue. And I can't stress enough how different your situation is to Cain's. But a coach who's working with an athlete is almost entrusted by that athlete to make them a better runner.
Right.
Is it ever okay for the coach to bring up weight with an athlete?
This is really hard. And I feel like a lot of coaches now especially are very, very paralyzed about, like, what do we do? Because it is – running has always – running, especially, well, all sports, there's been a weight aspect, but there's definitely a correlation there with running. I think that there is a way to talk about it that can be supportive. But the issue is that it is very, you know, it's very contextual in terms of, like, if you have a very good relationship with your athlete as a coach, then you may have a safer space to be able to talk about that. I'm more watched for cues if the athlete brings it up him or herself repeatedly. So if an athlete is like, I don't know, maybe do I need to lose weight? Do I need that actually, like, the fixation on the weight may actually signal to the coach that there is an underlying issue there, for instance. And it might be more in terms of, like, in a way to broach weight, and that it shouldn't be about a number on the scale. It should be about energy. It should be about, you know, like, how they're feeling day to day in their workouts. Are they recovering well? It's really funny. When I started eating well again, when I went into treatment, I was like, man, I have so much more energy, and my body doesn't feel so awful after every run, for example. And so I think that there's a way to talk about it that's more about, like, how you're feeling day to day. Are you recovering? You know, are you sleeping well?
Yeah.
I don't think that I'm a person who is like, there should be absolutely no discussion whatsoever, completely off the table. Because I think that there are people who can have a completely normal and healthy relationship with a number on the scale and just view it as a data point. I actually really wish that I'm hopeful I can get to that point where I can look at a weight on the scale and not have any emotional attachment to it whatsoever. It's just a number. It's just a data point. It doesn't have any impact on my self-worth, et cetera, et cetera. And so there could be athletes for them that in that situation that it's completely fine to talk about weight because they have no emotional attachment to it.
Yeah, I suppose that's the art of reading your athletes as a coach and having their best interests. I've always thought, and my take on this would be, that weight obviously matters for performance, but you don't address weight by addressing weight. You address weight by addressing diet and training and recovery, and then you allow the athlete's physiology to tell you what the weight needs to be. Because as long as you're optimizing the input side of the equation, the output side of the equation works. And I think you alluded to that when you said that since the treatment, and this is really going to be my last question because we've taken so much of your time, so I'll let Mike wrap up after this, is you go to this clinic in Seattle, I think it's just in Seattle, right?
Yes, yeah, in Seattle.
And you spend the time there enough that you now feel, you've obviously grown and understood yourself to the point of communicating this with the world, and you're now back, you raced at the weekend, for instance, the toughest mudder. What are the road signs or the landmarks, if you wish, that you're now looking at to reassure yourself that you're okay and that this is going well?
Yeah, I think for me, it's very much how I'm feeling in terms of recovery and day to day with my training, in terms of how I'm sleeping. I do have a team that kind of holds my weight and monitors that, but that's not, I mean, I'm not at this point, I'm not the one that's keeping track of that on my own. But it is very much just about, it is about feel and it is about engagement. And for me, it's mainly, the main part is the psychological part, is about like how much of my time am I spending obsessing over food and those kinds of issues. And so, you know, it's different for each person, but it is very much, just thinking about like how much of my life is spent thinking about it for me.
Amelia, thank you very much for your time. I think it's been a fascinating discussion and I really do appreciate being so open with us about this. I think my final question is, if there was one message in a sentence you wanted to get out, and you've been very vocal about this over the last year, what is that one message that you want people to take home from your experience?
Yeah, I think that the one thing is also to, you know, that eating disorders are super complex. They never look the same. And so it is something that is very individualized to a person, and that weight typically may not always show how badly a person is struggling. And I think in terms of the athletic and the performance side, is also very much for people to understand that there is kind of this, I am a firm believer in this set point type of physiology, and that, you know, the quote unquote ideal weight for an athlete that is the exact same height as a different athlete may be completely different, because your body just may function at a certain weight better than a different weight. And so I think that each athlete kind of needs to figure that out for themselves, and understand that it's kind of an area where when people are like, okay, well, how do you know when you're at a good weight or something like that? And I say it's a weight at which, you know, your body is functioning. For women, like your cycle is normal, your hormones are normal, you know, you're recovering well, you're not being constantly injured. And those are kind of the things to look at. You know, it's not the number on the scale.
Amelia Boone, thank you very much for your time.
Yeah, thank you.
Follow the Science of Sport podcast at Sports SciPod and on Instagram at Science of Sport Podcast.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic-butter shrimp scampi. Mm. HelloFresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.